Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Perhaps you've seen the film Ferris Bueller's Day Off, also known as Ferris macht Blau in German. Towards the end of the film, Ferris and his friends find themselves in a joyful parade on the streets of downtown Chicago. It's the Steuben Day Parade, which honors one of America's founding fathers, who was born in Germany, which was Prussia at the time. This man was a military commander by the name of Friedrich Wilhelm August Heinrich Ferdinand von Steuben. Von Steuben served under George Washington and modernized the Continental Army. Of course, the city of Chicago did not exist during the War of Independence, but Chicago has a long history of German immigration starting in the 19th century. And the Steuben Day Parade is one way that Chicagoans celebrate their German heritage. So today we're going to do a deep dive into the history of German Chicago with a global expert on the subject, Dr. Sebastian Wupper. Welcome, Sebastian.
Hi. Glad to be here.
It's great that you don't have as many middle names as von Steuben, or do you?
I just have one. And it's Peter, so it's fairly simple.
Okay. Sebastian Wupper received his PhD in history and his MA in public history from Loyola University Chicago. A native of Berlin, Germany, he wrote his dissertation on the 19th century German-American milieu in Chicago. He is currently engaged as a postdoctoral scholar with Loyola University Chicago, researching and documenting the entanglement of the university in the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. He also works as an expert consultant and a writer for high school level history textbook projects. So, Sebastian, just so you know, in previous episodes, we learned about the history of Chicago and the Great Lakes region from the end of the Ice Age, about 12,000 years ago, through the early 1800s. We discussed Native American history and the beginning of European settlements in the region. Then we learned about the War of 1812, and we learned that the Potawatomi Indians, who were allied with the British, burned Chicago's Fort Dearborn to the ground in August of 1812. They also captured Detroit and were actually in a position to regain control over the Great Lakes region. However, the British sold out their Native American allies in the treaty that ended the war. This treaty, which returned the Great Lakes region to the pre-war status quo, basically allowed the U.S. government to continue its unchecked expansion into the Midwest and beyond. By 1816, a new Fort Dearborn had been built by the U.S. government, and Native Americans were slowly being forced further west, often at the point of a bayonet. By 1830, Chicago was no longer an isolated trading post in the middle of Indian country. In fact, it was on its way to becoming the Western metropolis that we know today. But still, when the town of Chicago was founded in 1833, it only had 200 inhabitants. However, by 1840, it had 4,500. By 1850, 30,000. By 1860, over 110,000. By 1870, 300,000. And by 1880, over 500,000. So Chicago is the world's fastest growing city during these decades of the 19th century. And that's worth repeating. It was the world's fastest growing city, going from a mere 200 residents to over 500,000 in under 50 years. Imagine being born in Chicago in 1830 and then being a 50-year-old and being like, what's happened here? So, of course, many of these new Chicagoans were German immigrants. So, Sebastian, how would you like to start telling the story of German Chicago?
So Chicago basically had some German elements from the city's very beginnings, as you hinted at, because, well, Chicago's first big boom happened in the 1830s, and that coincided with one of the first big waves of immigration from what would later become, well, unified Germany. I mean, it's that's kind of one of the other things when you talk about Germany at the time. It's kind of difficult to define because that's the German Confederacy, the Deutsche Bund, and it's like it, Germany only really becomes a unified entity in 1871. But anyway, that's kind of a thing, something for the pedants, if you want to be pedantic about these things.
Well, let's define our terms then. When we're talking about German immigration, do you just think of it more generally as German speakers from any number of, like, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or
like in some ways that is how many Americans thought about this. You will find many immigrants who spoke German primarily and come from places that have German, you know, place names, who are slotted into being German by the American authorities, even though they come from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So it's kind of an interesting question how these people perceived of themselves. Generally, I would think, personally, I would think of people who spoke German as being part of the larger German cultural sphere, and therefore having some degree of Germanness within them. It becomes interesting if you start looking at the later immigrants, the people who partook in the revolutions, because these people believed in sort of like a greater German project, and so they had an allegiance to a fatherland that didn't really quite exist as a political entity at the time. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
As we know, this gets really complicated really fast, and that's why we have a historian to explain it. So again, if you had to start telling the story of German Chicago, how would you start that story?
So I would start by saying that when Chicago officially received its city charter from the state of Illinois in 1837, the voter rolls for the first mayoral election already contained 13 German names. And that is only those Germans who knew enough English and who were eligible to vote, and also the ones who made an effort to actually cast a ballot. So we have 13 German names in the first election. And that we can assume, or at least the early German historians who write histories of German Chicago in the 1880s, then list altogether about 30 German names among the earliest settlers.
So about 30 out of these 200, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that's a significant amount. Yeah.
And then in 1839, you have someone who's either Carl or Clemens. The first name is not, like, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other, so it's not entirely certain. But C. Stose, who was the first German-American who was elected to the position of alderman. We do not know which party he belonged to, as the pertinent records onto that were lost in the Great Fire of 1871. And that should also be a side note. If we talk about the early history of Chicago, it tends to be an issue that this Great Fire burnt so many things up, because that ends up making the records a little spotty.
Interesting. So what can you tell me about the first German? Is that this Stose chap?
Stose is the first German American alderman. Okay. And the early Germans, in terms of their political affiliation, they tended to be affiliated with the Democratic Party, because the Whig Party, then the opposition to the Democrats, because the Whig Party was generally more nativist and anti-immigrant. And out of the Whig Party come the so-called know-nothings, the people who just agitate against any kind of immigration to the United States. Because of those connections, at least the early Germans are going with the Democrats, because the Democratic Party at this time was actively recruiting immigrant voters. And so we can't assume that Clemens Stoser, that his political affiliation was with the Democrats. But there is, as I said, like we don't know for sure. That's just something I can't assume. But also the Germans were, as this sort of shows, like the Germans organized themselves fairly early on as sort of like a more or less cohesive political unit, and took part in elections, but also took part in demonstrations and just defending their Germanness also to the outside to some degree. And that becomes an issue as time goes on, because Germans with German cultural traits as being merry, getting together, and drinking copious amounts of lager beer means that they quickly ran afoul of the temperance movement.
Okay. Interesting. In the notes that you sent to me, you said there is a strong contender for the first German.
I was thinking about Stoser in that regard, and that's okay. Because
what else? So we know, you told me a little bit about his political background, and he was the first alderman. What else do we know about him? Was he a businessman, a trader?
That's pretty much it.
We don't know anything else about
him. Yeah, the early stuff is fairly difficult to sort of like suss out what these people were doing exactly. Like most. I mean, most of the German immigrants who came to the Midwest in general and ended up being farmers or small artisans. It's with the 48er generation that you get some people who are involved in different things, because these people who took part in the revolutions, they tended to, like those revolutionary ringleaders, they tended to be politicians and lawyers and men of letters, if to employ that term. And the people who came earlier, they were mostly like, you know, artisans. Like if they're in the city, they're usually artisans of some sort.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the 48ers, but before we get to the 48ers, let's talk about the Dreisiger, the 30s. What do we know about the Germans who came to Chicago in the 30s? Again, using the word Germans in this very loose sense, we've decided. You said that they're mostly farmers, maybe some artisans. Any idea of, did they come from a specific part of Europe? What do we know about the Dreisiger, the 30ers?
So the earlier immigration waves, they usually come from like southwestern Germany. That's where the earlier immigration waves come from usually, and this early immigration wave is for the most part caused by a number of bad harvests, high prices, and then also like high prices for agricultural goods and other things, which would be good for farmers. But the problem is that because of the local land inheritance laws, people, well, especially young men, end up with ever shrinking land inheritance, because in those parts of Germany, land holdings were divvied up between all the siblings to somewhat equal by somewhat equal measure, and that produces these ever shrinking lands that increasingly could no longer support their owners, and so leaving the homeland for other parts of the world becomes then more attractive, and that's where especially the Dreisiger fall into. But the Germans not only went to the US, they also went to Brazil, they also went to other places in South America, and then also to Eastern Europe. So at the time, the US is not yet the prime target necessarily. That only really develops later on, especially with the 48ers. However, the Dreisiger are the first significant wave of German immigration to the United States, where in 1832, German immigration for the first time exceeds 10,000 people a year to the U.S.
Interesting. So we have these, the Dreisiger, and this Stoser was part of the Dreisiger, or he preceded them.
No, I'm pretty sure he was he was part of that movement.
And you mentioned he was an alderman. What part of the city was that at the time? Do we still recognize it today?
I would think that must have been the north. What later becomes the north side, or the near north side, because the German settlement, or the German part of Chicago, is basically what today is Old Town, mm-hmm. and just on the north side of the river.
Okay. Let's move on now to the second wave of German immigrants, namely the 48ers. You note that some of them left for political reasons, and they did rise to prominence then in Chicago later. So why don't you describe, and again, I have to say this in great, with air quotes, Germany, which didn't exist really in 1848, but what was the political upheaval that forced them to the United States and then to Chicago?
Well, if we talk about the 48ers, we have to differentiate first between the generation and then as sort of like the wave of immigrants, and then the people who are in the more narrow sense, the 48ers, so the revolutionaries. Because the revolutions, as most revolutions, are carried out in the broad spectrum by the masses, by working people, but they are organized and thought up in a way by these people who we would call revolutionaries, the revolutionary ringleaders, who are more active and who are more active in local politics.
And what are they trying to do in the German speaking sections of Europe at the time? Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do, what their idea is, that they want to organize Germany, which at this point would be the German Confederacy, Prussia, Bavaria, and the various smaller statelets and duchies and baronies and whatnot, and they're trying to organize that into one cohesive nation state, into what we today would be thinking of as a nation state. And so what they're doing is they rise up against the nobility. And they essentially try to organize this country along a national kind of like a long national line. So basically what they are nationalists at a time when being a nationalist is kind of the new cool thing to be and do, because before that didn't, like, that idea didn't necessarily exist before, especially not before the Napoleonic Wars. The Napoleonic Wars galvanize this idea of Germanness as a cohesive national identity, sort of like against things that are French. Mm-hmm. And in the wake of that, you get amongst especially university students this idea that Germany should be organized as a larger whole that is not as divided between, you know, Prussia and Bavaria and, mm-hmm. and the Austro-Hungarians and all of these things. And that's essentially what the 48ers want to achieve with their revolutions. And the important part there is that the 48ers look to the United States and the way that the United States employ federalism as a federal republic, as the political role model for what they want to turn Germany into. They want to turn Germany essentially into a federal republic modeled on the United States. And that's one of the big reasons why they come to the United States after the revolutions fail.
Okay, so they fail and then they need to basically escape persecution.
Yeah, yeah.
They were violent, or government agents were on their trail.
Basically, some of them also just basically leave Germany because they're just really frustrated with those things not working out in the way that they thought they should have. So, like, one of the people I studied, he ended up being incarcerated for a year or 2 years, and then he emigrates to Germany after he gets out.
He immigrates to the U.S. then.
Yeah,
and then to Chicago. Mm. And so he was not a farmer or a small artisan.
No.
He was an educated university student first.
Yes.
Okay, why don't you tell me a little bit about this person?
Yeah, so Wilhelm Rapp grew up, he was the son of a Lutheran minister and poet Georg Rapp. And Wilhelm was then set to become a minister himself. He took up the study of theology in the seminary of Blaubeuren at the University of Tübingen. And during his time at the university, Rapp joined the fraternity Normannia Tübingen in 1845. And there he was introduced to this nationalist Republican ideology. And he became president of the Tübinger People's Association in 1848, attended a gathering of revolutionary Republican associations in Reutlingen in May of 1849, and then he organized a group of 50 men, mostly university students and laborers, to lend support and crossed from Württemberg into Baden, because Baden was kind of this hotbed of revolutionary fervor and a short-lived republic. And then when the Baden military was defeated less than a month later in 1849, Rapp fled to Switzerland, where he took a stint as a teacher at a private school, and then again returned to Schwaben, a region on the Kingdom of Bavaria's western border, to visit his parents. And there he was arrested and charged with high treason, and then spent 7 months incarcerated in the fortress Hohenasperg. And then he was disappointed and frustrated by the state of affairs in Germany and emigrated to the United States in 1852.
And then what was his life like in Chicago?
Rapp comes to Chicago fairly late, because most of the people who eventually end up in Chicago, they first end up in New York.
They land in New York first, yeah.
He is an interesting figure, all right, because he runs the Baltimore Wecker, so a newspaper out of Baltimore that's strongly abolitionist, and that brings up onto his own person the ire of the pro-slavery people and at the dawn of the Civil War, basically, and he has to flee the city because they are basically out to lynch him as the editor of this newspaper. And he flees the city in under the cover of night, and then makes it to Washington. And there is this legend that Abraham Lincoln offers him the position of Postmaster General, which is, it's a legend, it's not really true. And then from there on out, as the as this refugee from Baltimore, basically, and with this with the reputation he has as the editor of the Wecker, he then ends up in Chicago as one of the editors of the Illinois Staatszeitung, one of the biggest German American newspapers of the Midwest.
Interesting. So he was basically a double outcast. He was first out of Tübingen or Baden. Or I'm sorry, Schwaben, and then cast out of Baltimore, Maryland, Maryland was a slave state. And finds himself in Chicago. Interesting. What else would you like to tell me about the 48ers in Chicago?
They're a really interesting bunch, because so what they do is they rise to, as you said earlier, they rise to positions of leadership in for the German community in Chicago. And what they do is they bring the German community of Chicago behind the Republican Party, or, well, away from the Democrats and then into the nascent Republican Party as it develops basically in the late 1850s. And that happens for a number of reasons. So first and foremost, the 48ers are, at least the 48ers in Chicago, are by and large strongly abolitionist.
Why is that?
They locate themselves against slavery because they see a parallel between the Southern slaveholding aristocracy and the nobility of Germany that they rose up against. And so they have this sort of like this logical conclusion is, we rose up against, you know, the nobility in Germany. Now we have a similar situation here. Plus they hold people in bondage, and that's not really something that we agree with. And so they organize against that. And then there's also an issue where the Democratic Party alienates them with the Kansas-Nebraska Acts and the Clayton Amendment, which is an amendment that a local Democrat, Stephen A. Douglas, or one of the like who runs against Lincoln, basically, but Stephen A. Douglas, who up to that point had been championed by the German community, Douglas puts his weight behind the Clayton Amendment, which would disenfranchise immigrants in Kansas Territory and basically make it impossible for immigrants to own land there. And that's sort of something that German Americans feel betrayed by, on top of the whole thing where the Democratic Party is for slavery. And so that they take then as kind of the inciting incident to really go against the Democrats and really throw themselves behind the Republicans, even though the Republicans come out of the Whig Party and have this reputation among the larger immigrant community to not necessarily be too positive on matters of immigration. But they sort of say, well, that's one thing. Ultimately, what matters more is that they're against the slaveholders. So that's why we organize behind them. And so then the German, well, then the 48ers in German Chicago, first they end up electing the Republican mayor. And then from there on out, after they have sort of proven themselves as this helpful political bloc for the Republican Party, they get roped in by the Lincoln campaign to help Lincoln get elected president, basically. And that's, and they successfully deliver the voting bloc, like the Germans, as Germans in Illinois largely come out for Lincoln. And that again, and that's then also a point of contention between the 30er and the 48er, because the 30er largely were not necessarily on board with changing their political allegiance, and also just saw it as a thing where the immigrants shouldn't necessarily meddle this much in local politics. And the 48ers in general have like a couple, they do a couple of things that are not necessarily the smartest moves in terms of endearing themselves to Americans. They do things where they organize Sunday sort of excursions outside of the city to hang out in parks and fields outside of the city to drink their, to get together, be merry, and drink their beer on the Sunday. But then they also make a point of marching past the packed American churches, yeah, and sort of like make fun of the, make a little fun of the church-going Americans. And that's, and then that then does not necessarily get them a lot of friends.
So it's interesting. A couple of things you said there are interesting. First of all, that they had organized themselves, at least the 48ers, into a clear voting bloc. And people who know the history of Chicago know that cohesive and unified immigrant voting blocs are wielded very well by politicians in the city. And if you can bring a voting coalition or a voting bloc, favors will be returned to you. But the other, yeah. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that's a thing that then also happens. So the and that's another guy who, well, eventually becomes the owner of the Illinois Staatszeitung, this newspaper, because he was found to be a brilliant orator who really managed to whip up the German saloon crowds, basically, to come out for the Republicans. And he, his name is Anton Kaspar Hesing. He was actually not a 48er. He came a little earlier. He goes to Cincinnati, and then and there he works at a grocery store, but then becomes involved in politics and finds that he has kind of a knack for political agitation. And then he comes to Chicago, and there he opens up a bricklaying business, or brick-making business, actually. And that's where he is then discovered as by the German Republicans as being this guy who can whip up the people. And for his accomplishments for the Republican Party, he gets rewarded with the office of sheriff. And it's kind of like one of these things where it was
normal,
like,
for like, Chicago.
Yeah, where I was like, that's awfully early for this to be a thing. And then because he's sheriff, that's a lucrative office, and he gets fairly wealthy through that. And that allows him then to buy into the Staatszeitung.
Now, was he whipping up the crowds in both German and in English, or his role was really just to, and I do want to get into to the language issues too, but the Stadtzeitung was clearly a German language newspaper, yep. but yep. Is this fellow, the sheriff, was he whipping up the German population auf Deutsch?
Auf Deutsch, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How slowly did these various generations, the Dreißiger and then the 48ers, sort of lose their German language culture?
That's an interesting question that has a lot of caveats to it. So the 48ers are instrumental in turning Chicago's public education at least a slight bit towards Germanness. They introduced German lesson in Chicago public education, for lack of a better word, in the 1860s. And that's like an ongoing point of contention. Should that be a thing? Should that not be a thing?
Teaching the German language.
Teaching the German language in public schools, yes. And so they maintain a fairly sizable, I want to say, German subculture to some degree, basically up until the United States entry into the First World War. And that's basically the breaking point, because with the entry into the First World War, anti-German sentiment really comes to a boiling point. And that's when most German Americans abandon their Germanness and just embrace being Americans. Yeah. And for other reasons, a lot of German language newspapers fold at the time, because any German language newspaper that was published in the US had to, by law, deliver a translation of every article they were publishing the next day to the post office the day before publication. And if you've ever worked in translation, that's not really something that not is
practical.
Yeah. And that basically breaks the neck of German America, and it never quite recovers after that.
But that's the First World War, and we're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the we've talked about the role of German Chicagoans in the abolitionist movement.
Hmm.
And I think it's funny that you note that they were also anti-temperance. But where did can you just describe this, their the anti-temperance thing? What's going on there? Because there's the stereotype that the Germans mm-hmm. like their beer. But it's kind of not a stereotype then, too, the way you're describing it.
Yeah, no, it's not. So the way I've seen it described, where this, like, there is a misunderstanding, like a cross-cultural misunderstanding that sort of leads to this point where the German, the prototypical German is described as this. Well, they drink beer a lot, so obviously they're drunk a lot. But there is a distinct difference in drinking culture between the English-speaking world and the German-speaking world. And that is that, and that's funny enough, still true today to some degree, where the Germans largely drink beer. They don't drink ales, they drink beer, they drink lager beer that is generally lower in alcohol content than what most of the English speakers drink. The English speakers drink spirits, whiskey, gin, and ales. You tend to get drunk a lot faster on these, and then also Germans don't necessarily get together to get drunk together. They get together to be together, and while they're together, there is drinking involved. And so from that comes this thing where Americans look onto this and like, well, they're hanging out, they're drinking beer, so they must be drunk all the time, which they're not necessarily, or not to the degree that the people who go to the the editors of the Staatszeitung describe as Schnapskneipen. so like Schnaps taverns, basically. Yeah. And that's where the Germans draw the ire of the temperance movement. In the 1850s comes to a big clash when Chicago elects a pro-temperance mayor who tries to basically outlaw drinking on the Sabbath, and tries to shut down a lot of the immigrant saloons. And then Germans and Irish joined together because, well, the Irish are also targeted by this because, mm-hmm. you know, like they're also stereotypically drunk. Now, whether or not the Irish are actually more drunk than the Germans, I can't really say that. That's not like I didn't study the Irish, but the Germans and the Irish work together in 1855 and basically organize what becomes known as the Lagerbier riot. And like this, and then they march on City Hall, and there's like almost a very violent, like it almost comes to a really violent confrontation with the police. But then
and they're rioting to guarantee that they're still able to brew and consume beer in the
basically
city.
Yeah basically. And then the like this riotous mob marches towards City Hall, but then bridge warden sort of like sees them coming and pulls the bridge up so they can't cross into the loop, so they can't actually reach City Hall. And then the mob kind of disperses, and that was that. But the mayor then gets ousted the next year, because at the time Chicago had mayoral elections every year.
Staying with the temperance subject, it sounds like there is also a religious part of this.
Yes.
And you mentioned much earlier that the Germans came, and the Dreisiger came from the southwest of Germany, which is a Catholic part. Was it also partly a Catholic versus Protestant thing, in that the 48ers, were they also by and large Catholic? Not practicing necessarily, but of a Catholic culture that was not anti-alcohol.
The 48ers are kind of difficult in that regard because they tend to be largely anti-clerical. Mm-hmm. So they're not anti-religion, they're anti-organized religion. And they come from various parts of the country, not necessarily just from southern Germany. And that's because the revolution was a national phenomenon. You had revolutions in Baden, but you also had revolutions in Saxony. You also had parts of the revolution that happened in Berlin. And so that's really from all over the place. So religion, like the religion, well, maybe as a cultural aspect to some degree plays a role for the 48ers, but not that much. Opposition to temperance is something that they mostly see as an American nativist opposition to immigration and to immigrants. And because the temperance movement is really employed across the decades from the 1850s onwards, repeatedly against the immigrants, and specifically in Chicago, in the Chicago context, specifically against the Irish and the Germans.
Fascinating. It just goes to show that there are always reasons that the nativist trend in American history has to demonize various immigrant groups. And obviously there are, I'm sure, temperate German and Irish immigrants, but painting an entire ethnic group with a wide brush is an easy way of preventing them from accessing, say, governmental power.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, the Germans were very good in Chicago at, as we said earlier, being a solid political bloc, which meant that they could enter the ruling classes, as it were. And I want to use that as our segue into the next big part of German Chicago history, and that is going into the Civil War.
Mm.
So the 48ers, we note, are anti-clerical, they're anti-slavery, and of course at this time then, getting into the late 50s and then the early 60s, the Civil War is approaching. How does German Chicago react to what's happening and the buildup to the Civil War and then the Civil War itself?
So the German Chicagoans follow the developments very closely. Or rather, the events that lead up to the Civil War are covered very closely in the German language newspapers. And then once the war breaks out, the Germans in Chicago are pretty fast in organizing volunteers to fight in the war. And to do that, they then draw in people like Friedrich Hecker, who was himself a leader in the like a military leader in the Baden Revolution. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of like at the time he had a fairly high standing among the revolutionaries too, because he was basically seen as a war hero. Sure, his efforts failed, but nonetheless, he was somebody that people knew and trusted and looked up to as somebody who was who had fought for German sort of liberation from the yoke of nobility. And they bring him into, well, actually, they organized this regiment of volunteers, and then basically approach him and say, "Hey, Colonel Hecker, we have organized a regiment for you. Would you like to lead this?" And he's first like a little like, okay, but eventually they convince him to lead this regiment. And the Chicago Germans are not alone there. Germans across the country organize. There's regiments out of New York. There's regiments out of Ohio who are among the first so-called ethnic regiments. It's still, like, to me, it's still weird to think of the German regiment as ethnic, but that's just how the past works. Most of them do eventually see action, and but as the Civil War progresses, they get blamed as being cowardly, and get blamed for a couple of defeats of the Union armies. But if you look into what was actually going on there, it's actually this was mostly baseless, mostly just blaming the immigrant regiments for the general defeats that the Union army had at individual battles, and that then gets picked up by the big Anglophone newspapers and played up, basically to some degree smear the immigrants and to further like some sense of anti-German sentiment. And yeah, and that then gets the newspaper people up in arms against like what's going on there. Like, that's not like our people are not cowardly, but they're kind of fighting a bit of a losing battle there, because just the Anglophone, there's more Anglophone newspapers than there is German language newspapers, and the Germans make for it, like the Germans in that regard just make for an easy scapegoat. Mm-hmm.
So do you happen to know how the construction of these regiments went on? Would this be something where young men would be gathered, as you noted, on one of their picnics where they're drinking lager beer, and they then get spoken to by someone like the baker/brickmaker, mm-hmm. who says, "This is something that we German Americans really need to support, and you need to now sign up for our German regiment and go off to the front." Is this kind of how this general process of recruitment would work for the German ethnic regiments?
In part, yes, but also what drove recruitment there was also the Turnverein. Okay, I think
you explain the Turnverein now. We're back to the Turnverein.
So the Turnverein is a kind of a curious thing. It's basically a gymnastics club that is also a political club and a place where people come to do some, you know, gymnastics, fitness exercises, drink beer, and talk politics, which seems kind of counterintuitive. But then, and then also, they are German nationalists because they come out of directly the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, and they really furthered this idea of German nationalism, and because of that, they were outlawed in Prussia, for example. Sort of like had to do their gymnastics practices in sort of like covertly. And then members of the 48 Revolution, a lot of them are members of the Turnverein as well, and they successfully, very successfully, transplant the whole thing to the United States as a social club, Where they then built the Turnhallen, that were, as Americans would call it, Turner Halls. Mm-hmm. Some of them are still around today, at least the buildings. I mean, the actual associations largely folded with the death of German America, and like mostly with the First World War. Some of them are still around as like sports associations. If they're still remnants of those organizations around, they are no longer, like, have long since ceased being political in any way, and are just really mostly just sort of athletics organizations, basically. But at the time, they were a very important social club, especially for the 48ers. They were largely, like, for the time, like the 48ers, they were largely progressive in terms of their politics. And in Chicago, they were very important in terms of organizing these volunteer regiments. Yeah, so like they would do volunteer drives at the weekly gatherings, and then they would also they would buy basically ads in the newspaper to say, hey, we're recruiting for this regiment. And then also, because the newspaper people had their own connections to the Turnverein, they would also then editorialize for that.
Do you happen to know about how many men were in this or these regiments from Chicago? Because Chicago in the 1860s isn't a huge city. It's still only 112,000 people.
Yeah, it wasn't that many, because the very first regiment was not just Germans. It was the first ethnic regiment, but it was a regiment that was not exclusively made up of Germans. I don't have exact numbers, though.
Okay, so let's move on to after the end of the Civil War, these German soldiers coming back to Chicago after the end of the Civil War. What is the city like for them, and what are their neighborhoods like?
So after the Civil War, or throughout the 60s, basically, the north side of Chicago becomes firmly German. And at the end of the 60s, it's in terms of demographics, it is thought that basically one out of three Chicagoans was born in Germany, or, well, what later becomes Germany, or is mm-hmm. you know, born in German speaking Europe.
And that's around 1870?
Yeah.
Wow, that's an amazing statistic.
So what happens after the war is that, so the Germans in Chicago are very active in mourning Lincoln, which is apparently not something that happened across the German speaking America. So what happens in Chicago is that the various singing societies, so let's, well, that requires kind of like another quick explanation. So first, you have the Turnverein, which is probably the most important social club, but Germans are a people of associations and societies, and another important group of associations and societies are the singing societies, the Gesangsvereine. After the war, what used to be a veritable chorus of singing societies, to abuse that term, they find themselves after the war being like having not enough members for all of these individual singing societies to keep going. And so at Lincoln's bier, as Lincoln is lying in state in Chicago, members of these various disparate singing societies come together, and while Lincoln is lying in state, they organize a new singing society that eventually becomes the Germania Männerchor, which is like an organization that exists well into the 20th century as kind of like the foremost Chicago singing society. I always found that kind of like an interesting tidbit, because like even today you see like there's the Germania building in Chicago. It's just like kitty corner from the Chicago History Museum. Mm-hmm. that goes back to these men meeting, basically getting together as Lincoln is lying in state, and they're like, okay, we want to sing some hymns to Lincoln, but our singing societies are all just, you know, just ravaged by the losses from the war. So we just reorganize. Mm-hmm. And that's where that comes from then. Yeah.
So I think this is maybe a good point to pause and end this first half of our look at the history of German Chicago. And for me, what's very interesting is how over the course of the 19th century, there is this ebb and flow, as it were, of how strong German cultural traditions are first imported into the U.S., into Chicago, and how they're able in certain ways to stay strong, and in other respects, they have to adapt to the new reality they're facing in Chicago. But it's still interesting that there are certain bedrocks of Germanic culture. Maybe that's a broader term we can agree to. And namely, it's the German language newspapers.
Mm.
And then it's these different types of community associations, I guess we'd call them.
Yeah.
The Turnvereine and the singing societies, which form basically bedrocks of maintaining German culture in Chicago.
Yeah, like the newspaper is, I mean, first of all, the newspaper is one of the things I studied the closest just because there is such a plethora of information there. I just found a very dense archive. They have like almost gapless coverage from basically the early Civil War up until the 1880s in the, at the Newbery
Library. Makes it easier for a historian, Chicago.
And because of that, I can show the central role that this newspaper played in like as this linchpin between the various societies, the political organizations, but then also between Germany, like between the German homeland and the German American community in Chicago, because they had correspondents who would write to them from the German homelands, or they would just send people there to write back home. And then also just because the United States had a free press and Germany did not, that then oftentimes resulted in some weird, like some really weird things where the German American press would sometimes report about things that happened in Germany faster than some German presses could, just because of the way that the telegraph worked, because the telegraph inside of Germany was not as well established as the telegraph was in the United States. But then if someone from Germany sent telegraphic news dispatch to the United States, that would happen faster than it could within Germany. And then also because of censorship laws, the newspaper in Germany and in the United States could be published quicker and with fewer hurdles than it could be in Germany. And so you have then like these weird things where, you know, the German American newspaper in Chicago will write about some happenings at Prussian court before the newspapers in Berlin will have necessarily written about that.
Interesting. So today we covered the early inhabitants of Chicago of Germanic ancestry. Namely, we had Stoza, the first German alderman. We discussed the Dreisiger, the Germans who emigrated in the 30s, as well as the 48ers. And we got a sense of how German culture sort of was a part of Chicago politics and more broadly American politics, with their support of Lincoln, with their support of abolition. And indeed, we saw that they were strong supporters of the Union cause during the Civil War. Now, in the second episode, we're going to take it from basically the end of the Civil War. But I think we need to then look at what's going on back in Germany, which again, we might be able to start talking about Germany as Germany in the next episode. And we'll look at how what was happening in Europe affected German Chicago. So, Dr. Wupper, thank you very much for giving us the first part of this history.
Sure.
And I look forward to discussing the second half of our history with you next time for our next episode. Danke schön.
All right. Gern geschehen.
Und auf Wiedersehen. And just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaZentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.